Jewish Education and Media is pleased to present L'Chaim, a program that highlights the people, issues, and events of importance to the Jewish community. Now here is your host, Rabbi Mark Golub.
I'm Mark Golub. Welcome to part two of my meeting with a very special rabbi and a very special human being, Shai Held, one of the leading rabbinic scholars on the American scene today, leading one of the critical educational initiatives on the world Jewish scene. Shai Held has ordination from JTS, the Jewish Theological Seminary of America, which is the conservative movement's rabbinical school. Shai also has a PhD from Harvard in religious studies. He's the author of a number of books, including a wonderful book on, I don't know, one of the greatest minds of the 20th century. It's entitled Abraham Joshua Heschel, The Call of Transcendence, which is a study of the major themes in Rabbi Heschel's writings. And in 2017, Shai Held published a two-volume collection of essays on the Torah called The Heart of Torah. And it is so lovely to have you sitting at this table once again. Thank you so much.
Thank you again for having me.
So in our first meeting, we talked a lot about your background and the journey you took, even how you became a rabbi, why you became a rabbi, why you picked JTS. And you talked about a lot about, and now I may be putting words in your mouth, so you'll correct it if I'm misstating it. What I heard you say is something like this. I wanted to be the kind of rabbi I wish I'd had as a child or as a teenager, and I wanted to create a context of learning, of studying Torah, which I would want to study in, that was both committed to Jewish values, that was also intensely interested in Torah as a source of Jewish values, but also was part of the modern world and understood the extent to which it had to be egalitarian, that it had to be open and also both embracing and critical of things in modern culture, which on the one hand might please you, on the other hand might disturb you greatly. To what extent do you feel I've adequately described what the Machon Institute is for you?
I think very adequately.
Okay.
Yeah.
Then I want to say to you that we spoke a lot about how you became who you became and what I talked to you about your soul. You have a very lovely, gentle soul, and you made the point this wasn't by accident. Part of it is what you were given by your parents and by God, but also you made a conscious decision to shape your life in a certain way. And you talked about it in some way in terms of your parenting. You want to be the parent you might not have had yourself. And it was a very loving description of what you wanted to be and what you hope to communicate to others. My sense of you is that this also reflects the kind of Judaism you've been teaching. That one of the things you've tried to impart to all those lucky enough to study with you, and I mentioned in part one of our meeting, JBS has been privileged to have many of your lectures on JBS, as well as the colleagues who helped you found the Hadar Institute. But it sounds to me like one of the things that you care about is creating a loving sense of Judaism and a loving sense of Torah. I want you to speak to that. To what extent am I, again, not romanticizing, but accurately describing your own perspective? And if I'm right, what does it mean to Shai Held to create a loving form of Judaism as opposed to some of the Judaism that disturbs you?
Right. Well, that's a very astute and large question. So let me try to kind of come at it from an angle. As you may know, I am now deeply immersed in writing a book arguing that love is, in fact, a central, if not the central, category for understanding Jewish theology, Jewish ethics, and Jewish spirituality. But I want to be clear what I mean by love in this context. Love is not an emotion or an action. Love is what I would call an existential posture, a way of holding myself in the world that includes emotion and action. It's not about what I happen to be feeling at a particular moment. It's about a disposition to feel towards others and towards God, and to act towards others and towards God in a particular way. Now, the context for this, I think, and I really want to underscore this because this is just enormously important to my work in the world. For thousands of years, Jews heard Christians talk about Judaism as a loveless religion. That Christianity was about love, whereas Judaism was about law or justice, whatever it was, but it wasn't love. And in ways that I think are profoundly tragic, that was internalized by Jews. And more than that, American Jews, who often had a very attenuated sense of their own Jewishness, consciously or not, I'm not sure, at a certain point began to define themselves as Judaism is whatever they think Christianity is not. So since Christianity is about love, Judaism must be about something else. Let's figure out what that is. Maybe it's justice, maybe it's law, maybe it's culture, whatever it might be. And the truth is that led to a profound distortion of what lies at the very heart of the Jewish tradition, in my view, which is a commitment to love. In the Torah itself, it's a threefold love. It's love of God, love of neighbor, and love of the stranger, the outsider. And what it means to live a life with God is to live a life oriented around love. Now, again, love is a term that can be just diluted and violated with cheap sentimentality. I'm not talking about the love at the level of a Hallmark card. I'm talking about here about really orienting one's life around love. And we have to kind of really, to understand that, really begin to explore what that means. What does it mean to love God? What does it mean to love the neighbor?
And I'm assuming it doesn't mean agape either. It's not the Greek notion of love as some kind of platonic ideal, is it?
It is, no, I think you have voices that speak that way. Look, personally, I'm extremely drawn to the interpretation of love your neighbor as yourself that is offered by Nachmanides, Ramban, one of the great medieval Jewish commentators. He says something that I find so moving and challenging. He says, you know, now this is obviously my very 21st century translation of what he's saying. He says, you know, a lot of us are fine with someone being successful as long as it's clear that we're more successful. They're fine if they're as wealthy as we are, as long as what we care about most, we're better at than they are. You can be as wealthy as I am as long as it's clear that I'm smarter than you are. You can be as smart as I am as long as it's clear that I'm wealthier than you are. And in fact, he says, love your neighbor as yourself in Hebrew, ve'ahavta lireyacha kamocha, which can be rendered as love for your neighbor as you love for yourself. What it means is to live with a generosity of spirit that genuinely wants for others what it wants for ourselves. I'll tell you that one of the things I was most committed to when I functioned for many years as the kind of the scholar in residence of Kehilat Hadar in New York City, every couple of years I would say at the beginning of Yom Kippur, I want to issue a spiritual invitation to you. I want you to think about the thing that you feel you need most in your life, that you really need. I want you to pray for other people to have it too, and to at least for a moment entertain, to pray that they get it first. That doesn't mean you don't want it. It doesn't mean you don't feel that you need it. It doesn't mean that you are selfless, but it means you are trying to live in a way that genuinely wants blessing for other people. That's a posture of generosity. Another way of maybe getting at this is when I talk about love, I'm really talking about a family of postures. That includes love, compassion, empathy, kindness, generosity of spirit. It's closely connected to gratitude that I think yields generosity. I'm talking about a kind of a cluster of emotions and postures that I think lie at the very heart of what Judaism is about, manifested in classical Jewish language as a commitment to chesed, to love and kindness towards others. That is the very heart of Jewish tradition as I understand it. And in many ways, what I've been trying to do as a teacher and as a writer is to put front and center this reading of the tradition. And I will say that, Mark, it breaks my heart because when I travel around the country, which I do constantly, and I talk about some of this, there are some people who are resistant and there are others who sit there with their mouth open. People will come up to me and say, why did no one ever say this to me? I have this talk I've been working on. I'm giving it a lot because I'm constantly rewriting it. Called, you know, the God of Torah is a God of love, undoing the stereotypes. And I've had people cry in that session. right? I thought the God of the Old Testament was a God of vengeance and justice. I like to say that that is the last permissible cultural stereotype. It's the only stereotype that's permissible in the pages of the New Yorker, right? You can talk about someone as having Old Testament levels of vengeance. That's just appalling, right? And Jews have internalized that. And it's just enormously problematic. And there is, the word I would use here is we need to heal from having been robbed and in some ways been complicit in allowing ourselves to be robbed of the very heart of what Torah is about and for.
I love it so much. I think you're not right. I think you're 1,000% correct. You use the word chesed. Explain what chesed is to our audience.
Well, it's very interesting. Chesed in the Bible means one of two things, and scholars kind of in some ways still debate what it means. On the one hand, it has the connotation of loyalty and faithfulness to our relationship, and on the other hand, it has the connotation of love and kindness.
Indeed, yes. Isn't, I have never seen a rabbinic text which uses the word chesed that doesn't involve some kind of behavior vis-a-vis the other people. Do you see it differently?
Yeah, well, I think in rabbinic literature especially, chesed becomes very concrete as deeds people do for one another.
Yes.
What I have argued, and I will be come right out and say, not everyone agrees with me on this point, what I have argued is that the Bible's ideal that is picked up by the rabbis, the ideal is emotion manifested as action. The ideal is integration.
Beautiful.
So that, for example, in rabbinic literature, you have some sources that say becoming like God is about having the attribute of mercy.
Correct.
And some sources that say becoming like God is about visiting the sick.
Correct.
And the ideal, as I am trying to...
And they are the same, are they not?
I don't know if they're the same, but ideally they are intertwined with one another.
In other words, in my mind, to say that one is merciful is empty.
Yes, 100%.
And what you're doing is you're giving content.
Right.
And I believe the content you are expressing is very rabbinic in content.
Yeah, so what I would say is this. You know, the rabbis prioritize action in the following way. If you said to almost any Jewish teacher, you know, through the ages, if you have a choice between someone who feels compassion and does nothing, and someone who feels nothing and concretely cares for people, they will always choose the latter. But that's like saying, given a choice between not ideal and worse, the rabbis choose not ideal and concluding that not ideal is in fact ideal. In other words, I mean, that was a little bit of a confusing formulation.
No, but I think you're being a bit harsh on the people who act compassionate, even if they do not emotionally experience it. But they are driven to be compassionate. And I don't want to judge what people's motivations are. And what I've learned from the Jewish tradition is it's not so much what a person tells you they believe. It's how you see them behave. So the compassionate person wins for me. I don't want to hear about a person who tells me they feel so compassionate, but I see in their actions they're not.
Right. Well, that 100%. I mean, because I think one of the things we know is that someone who says they're compassionate but doesn't act compassionately, the compassion is in fact fraudulent. Right? Emotion that doesn't manifest as action is inherently suspect emotion. Right? Philosophers now talk a lot about how emotions are inherently motivating. So if at a certain level I never manifest compassion in the world, what I feel, maybe narcissism masquerading as compassion. It's not compassion, right? But that said, I don't think there's anything wrong, and I think, in fact, tradition is very clear about this. It articulates an ideal that I should aspire to, even if I can't live my entire life there, of not only am I caring for you, Mark, when God forbid you're in mourning, but I feel care for you as
absolutely.
I do it.
Absolutely.
And that, I think, is actually really important to put back on the table. Judaism places action first, but it decidedly does not place action only at the center.
Correct.
That's a really important argument, in my view, for recovering a healthy sense of what Judaism is. I always like to say to my students, you know, they always kind of tease me about this, that, you know, Judaism's answer to almost every either-or question is yes, right? So in Judaism, is love an emotion or an action? You're right, that's exactly what it is. It's exactly what it is. Ideally, it's an emotion that manifests as an action. Do I have to act lovingly even when I don't feel love? Absolutely. Can I hope and aspire that acting lovingly will in fact elicit a feeling of love too? Also, absolutely. But I don't want to lose sight of the ideal, even as we don't want to like attack people, regular people like you and me, who can't live up to it at all moments,
okay,
which none of us do.
Come back to the experience you've had as you take this message across the country to synagogues all over the place.
Yeah.
And I'm fascinated by the extent to which you have noticed, I believe appropriately so, that many, many Jews grow up with no sense of what you're talking about. And my question for you is, why is that? How could that have happened? And why is it that your message becomes so important because it hasn't been heard throughout people's lifetime? How did that happen, Shai?
Well, again, so let me go back to where I was before. You know, the historian David Nierenberg talks about how Christianity fundamentally, historically, put out a narrative according to which Judaism and Islam both suffered from an ailment called lovelessness, right? They were fundamentally unloving religions. And the question is, what happens when a majority culture tells you over and over and over again that this is what you are? I think in ways that are often unconscious, you end up internalizing that. And then again, I actually think that at a certain point in American Jewish history, something broke. Look, we feel in other ways too, Mark. Here's a very dramatic example. I have been asked literally countless times on the road, is grace a Jewish idea? Right? So one of the texts that I often present people is the second to last chapter of Maimonides' Guide to the Perplexed, where he says, right, the meaning of the word chesed is that either I owe someone something and I choose to give them more than I owe them, or I owe someone nothing and I choose to give them something anyway. And then he says, and the creation of the world is an example of that second thing. God owes us nothing, and yet there the world is. The existence of the world is an act of divine grace. None of us did anything to earn it, right? I would say somewhat playfully, Judaism believes in creation by grace alone. That's what Judaism believes in. You know, now, if you say to American Jews very often, what does the word grace even mean? They can't tell you. It's associated with salvation by grace alone as Christians use it. But the notion of grace, I've been given something I did nothing to earn. And I say this to people all the time. The fact that you are alive, it is simply a logical entailment that you did nothing to earn the gift of life. None of us ever did anything. None of us could ever have done anything to earn the gifts of life and consciousness. And there they are. According to Jewish theology, that's grace. And I will have people say to me, I didn't know that was a Jewish thing. I mean, literally, rooms full of people. By the way, people who have learned a lot, actually.
Okay. I want to come back to Chesed, though. Because you went to JTS. Are you telling me that the perspective of Torah that you learned, or that you now are able to articulate, was one that was not the general sense of what you were taught in a rabbinical school like JTS? Only that Scheinheld had to develop this after you left JTS? And that's when I say to you, how could this be? What I'm really saying to you is, as you look at the way rabbis are trained and how rabbis think, why aren't rabbis in general delivering and sharing your message? Why is it that when you come into a community, you're the first guy to say this?
So I will tell you, at the risk of having a pipe dream, I hope that if I have a real influence in the community, it's in part in that people are starting to talk this way. I would say that if there were people saying this in JTS, I didn't hear it.
Mm-hmm. Okay, and I'm going to take you, I believe you're describing the truth. My question is, these are good people.
Yeah.
These are people committed to the Jewish tradition.
Right.
Why do you think it is, that at JTS you didn't hear this?
Well, I think that at JTS in the years that I was there, we were still very much living in a culture that was about academic Jewish studies, in which making kind of active theological claims about talking about what it meant to cultivate a life of the Spirit was not really part of the discourse. Mm-hmm. Just not what we did. Mm-hmm. And I'll tell you, I'll give you an example, something that happened to me. You know, I was giving a Dvar Torah, a short teaching to some classmates late in my time at JTS, in my fifth year. And I said, Jewish theology essentially centers around the claim that God loves us and invites us to reciprocate that love. And one of my classmates said, I will never forget this. He sort of blurted out in this very dismissive way, wow, you really do spend way too much time with Christians. And I said, you know, it's so interesting that you say that, because you're thinking of Christians. I was thinking of the daily sitter, in which we say every morning, Ahavara ba'avtanu, with vast love have you loved us, and then follow it with, Ve'avtat Adonai Elohecha, and you should love the Lord your God. That is about God loving us and inviting us to reciprocate. The fact that you associate that with Christianity is just heartbreaking to me.
Yes, but what does it say to you? Because I believe the student who said that to you is reflecting a notion that is not simply in the air in the Jewish world, but it's something he's been taught. I believe that there is in Jewish education, and here I'm not being critical, I'm just describing, there is a notion that although that's what the prayer book says, the Jewish tradition has a spin on it that has to do with really what it means to love God. And here we will come to something I do want you to talk about. To what extent is loving God really, in the Jewish tradition, it is always expressed in how you treat other people. The notion of loving God as a disembodied something is something I don't understand. And I believe most of the people whom you talk to, in rabbinical school and out, for them, the idea of loving God as if God were an object, and you and I understand the Jewish tradition would never make God an object. But what it means to love God as if, you know, you said before, the three things we're to love: God, fellow Jew, stranger. Remember saying that? Okay. And I'm saying to myself, oh, I got to come back to this, because I understand what Shai means when he says you love your fellow Jew. And I understand what the Jewish tradition means in no uncertain terms. It is required of the Jew to love the other with one proviso: that other can't be trying to kill you. But you love the other and you love the Jew. And then I said to myself, what does Shai Held mean when he says love God? Because instinctively my reaction is, I know that's how the poetry of the prayer book goes, but it's not what the rabbinic tradition means. The rabbinic tradition always interprets loving God in terms of what you do to other people, which becomes even more important, it seems to me, in a modern context where most of the Jews I meet aren't even sure there is a God. What do you say?
Well, I would say this. I would want to nuance the way you asked that question and say that in the Jewish tradition, both biblical and rabbinic, you can't love God without loving the other, and whether or not you love God is manifest in how you treat other people. But the love of God cannot be reduced to the love of neighbor. There is still an aspiration to have a relationship. Now, I understand for many modern Jews this is complicated or sounds like Martian some of the
time. But even in the rabbinic period, it's complicated.
Yes, it's complicated, but I think that there very clearly, in other words, the notion that love of God equals love of neighbor without remainder, I don't think is an accurate reading of the rabbinic tradition. I think there is the aspiration to have an emotional connection to God that is mediated often through the experience of prayer, through the experience of learning Torah. For the rabbis, I'll give you, here's an example of this that I think is totally gorgeous. What an amazing image from the rabbinic tradition. Song of Songs Rabbah, the classic rabbinic midrash on Song of Songs, describes two people talking about Torah, the conversation they have. Song of Songs Rabbah describes that as puckering their lips and kissing God, right? It's not just about how they talk to each other.
But even there, what you've got is people engaged in a human activity And the rabbis,
but it's poetically not just about the
describe
ethics.
That as that's how you how do you kiss God? You are engaged in Torah. That I understand, and that to me, the what you've just quoted is the essential rabbinic understanding.
But that's not the reduction of all love of God to ethics. That's also about dedicating my mind to being connected to God. It's about loving the good, right? Now, yeah, again.
Loving the good?
No.
Oh, wait. Loving the good sounds different than loving God.
Well, so let me clear what I mean by that. Jews love the good in part, but this is very messy. I don't know if we want to do this right now.
Yes, we do. How often do I get to talk to somebody like this?
So let me say this. So first, let me talk for a minute about, in the Bible, the relationship between loving God and loving other people. To me, the most powerful formulation of this is in the 10th chapter of Deuteronomy, in which God is described as Ohev Ger, God loves the outsider. And the very next verse says, Ve'avtem et Ager, and you must love the outsider. And what I imagine is going on there, I think it's actually pretty clear that what's going on there, is you imagine someone who says to God, God, I love you. And God says, oh yeah, that's really nice, but I love widows and orphans. So if you're going to love me, you got to love them too.
Exactly.
But wait, Mark.
Exactly.
But wait. Because where I want to go next is to say, but I don't think that means only that. Jews also express love for God in what we traditionally call mitzvot that are between a person and God.
I know. Give me
keeping
an example.
Keeping Shabbat, keeping kosher. I understand your viewership is very diverse. Not everyone shares those practices.
You described your own childhood. You just had your own childhood. You were not Shomer Kashrut in home.
Right.
Your parents never lit a Friday night candle.
I would not describe my parents as loving God. I wouldn't describe them that way.
Okay. So you're thinking people who light Friday night candles are expressing a love of God?
No. I think that lighting candles can be an expression of love of God. Right? In other words, look, here's the thing. There's two temptations in Jewish life. Let's call it right now, just for play, the liberal temptation and the conservative temptation. I don't mean those terms politically, I mean them religiously. The liberal temptation is to say, okay, I know what love of God is. Love of God is ethics. The conservative temptation is, I know what love of God is. It's keeping mitzvot, right? And the truth is, it's both of those things. And it's also, here's a midrash that I find very moving. I'm embarrassed to say I never saw this midrash until a few weeks ago, but I'm processing it these days, so I'll share it with you. The midrash imagines God saying, Kol ma she'atem osim, everything that you do, lo tasu ela me'ahava, only do it out of a place of love. That's, love there is not an action. Love there is a kind of emotional, existential posture. And I'm suggesting that in traditional Jewish thought, there is the yearning to love God, not only through ethics, but to love God as God. Now, is that mediated by observance and learning and prayer? Very often, most often, yes. But I don't, you know, I'm in a sort of paradoxical place here. On the one hand, I have spent my entire life emphasizing the utter centrality of ethics and the radical,
yes,
ethical, the radical ethical demands of Torah.
Yes.
Yet I don't think the love of God simply reduces to radical ethics. I think it includes the yearning to have a relationship. Now, here's the dilemma in modernity. Many Jews believe many different things about who and what God is, if they believe in God at all. I'm totally open to that conversation. But what I don't want to do is read kind of 21st century religious struggles right back into the Talmud so that they're saying what we're saying. I think actually struggling with the gap between us and them is important, right? I don't actually think that it's valuable to say, oh, well, this is all that I feel capable of believing, so therefore kind of that's going to be my reading of the rabbinic tradition. I'm comfortable with the gap. I'm not always comfortable with it. I want to embrace the gap.
Between
what the tradition believes is possible and what in my own experience sometimes feels impossible.
Very fair.
Eros in the biblical understanding of God's relationship with Israel and Israel's relationship with God.
Okay. I understand, by the way, I don't want to be misunderstood. I know there are people who fervently believe and feel a love for God. I am not minimizing that, and I'm not trivializing that. I am concerned about the Jew for whom, at the moment, in that person's spiritual journey, that has no meaning.
Right.
And I believe more Jews are there than are Jews who would say, I have come to love God. I also, my own reading of the Jewish tradition, and I'm not reading into Talmud, I believe the rabbinic tradition clearly is patient with and understands that for most human beings, if you're lucky, every now and then you'll have that moment where you feel one with the Shekhinah, or you have a sense of, all of a sudden everything is clear for an instant, and you use Maimonides a lot. I am taken by Maimonides saying the difference between us and prophets is the moment of lightning only occurs more often, but a sense of being in relationship to God is like a moment, a flash of lightning. It is not something that happens to a person, and from then on, it can go up on their wall. They have, like, 100%. They have,
okay. Right.
So that what Jews do is struggle with that reality, and if they're lucky, they'll come to it every now and then. And the issue is, how does a Jew live in the meantime? And therefore, when you talk about love of the other and the emphasis your whole career has been on putting, if you love, it's got to be expressed through the way you treat other people. I believe that's the essential rabbinic message. By the way, I don't believe it's the biblical message. I believe the message of the Bible is a very different message. And that the rabbinic tradition turns the message of the Bible on its head. The God of the Torah is not the God that you will quote in Midrash. But that's a separate issue.
Yeah, so here I disagree with you fiercely, fervently, and even ferociously.
Isn't that interesting? Okay, go. Tell me
meaning
why.
Meaning, I think the God of Deuteronomy over and over again says, if you love me, you will create a society in which everyone is treated as your family.
I agree 1,000%.
If you love
me,
1,000%. You will emulate my love.
Yes. In the book of Deuteronomy, however, it also says that there are blessings and curses. And I will curse the hell out of you if you don't do what I tell you to do. I don't find that at all in rabbinic literature.
Well, rabbinic literature believes that the temple was destroyed because Israel sinned.
I understand that. But the rabbis don't go around threatening us.
Yeah, I understand that.
And the God of the Midrash, is never portrayed as a God who... The God of the Midrash is somebody you'd like to sit with and learn from, and who has empathy for you. The God of the Torah is a God who goes around killing people all the time. And by the way, I don't fall into anything.
Careful.
The God of the Torah is a marvelous moral imperative. But the spirit of God in the Torah is not the same God of the Midrash. And I'm happy to have that debate with you any day of the week.
Yeah, we can talk about this because I actually think it's far more complex than you're putting it. The dichotomization there is too stark. It'll be my work to convince you of this in my next project.
And by the way, you would be more comfortable if I said it's not a dichotomy. It's where the emphasis is put.
That's a very different sentence.
Yes.
It's a very different sentence. Yes. Walked back, I think, some of the way you put it.
No, I like what you said. I will say it there because you'll be more comfortable, and I think it'll be more accurate. There's an emphasis. There is one of the things you said early in our first hour was that as you were growing up, you said to your father, a biblical scholar at Columbia University, so who wrote the Torah? And you said to me, you asked it as a fourth grader. That question can be asked, but when Heschel asks that question, Heschel has an answer for that question. But that's a question that can be asked by anybody of any age. And the issue of what you mean and what a Muncie Orthodox Jew means by the phrase Torah Misinai, that the Torah comes from Sinai, I believe is very different for you than it is for a Jew from Muncie. and you can tell me I'm wrong.
No, no, 100%.
Okay. And I'm saying to you that for me, if somebody says to me, is the Torah Mi-Sinai? I say the answer is yes, in the Heschelian model, not in the Munsee model, that the Torah is somehow the Jewish people's response to what they heard at Sinai. It is not God's literal writing of what happens at Sinai. And for me, the Torah, the genius of the Torah, as understood by the rabbis who then create this marvelous midrash, is that Torah is truth as poetry is truth. The Torah is prose poetry. Is it true? Absolutely. Is it true in factual detail? Not at all.
I'm not sure why you just ended up here.
Because for me, what I'm saying is that the God of the Torah is a God that comes out of a specific time and place of where our people were. And the description of God is not literal. When it talks about a God who decides to kill somebody because he violates the Shabbat, there is no, for me, and you can tell me, I would be curious to know if you agree or disagree. For me, there's no God in this universe who tells a father to take his child to Moriah and sacrifice him as a test of his loyalty to God. There is no God in the world who does that. But there is a message there, a poetic, moral, powerful message about where does child sacrifice fit in terms of Jewish life, and what is our relationship to God, and how do we struggle. All of that is true, except the literal reading of it.
Right.
In the Torah, God tells Abraham to take his, in the Midrash, the entire story is turned on its head.
Yeah, but Mark, here what I would say is, you are here prioritizing moments in Midrash that are incredibly gentle. The fact is that I think if I put certain texts in front of you, you would give the same speech with the same passion about how the God of the Midrash is, there is no God in the universe, etc., etc. All texts can be historically situated. I think the question is, and this I think really goes to the question you asked me about JTS and my experience there. Once you're done situating a text in history, do you still believe it makes a claim on you? And my relationship to the Jewish tradition, and I totally understand why people adopt different positions from this, I never want to stand over a text. I want to stand under it. Now, does that mean that I sometimes read rebelliously? Do I sometimes read against the grain of the text? For sure I do. But to me, that's not Bible versus Midrash. That's about the Jewish tradition as a whole, making space for our own religious and moral intuitions and allowing us to read as heirs of the tradition, to borrow a term from Leon Wieseltier, as heirs of the tradition rather than puppets, right? I think that's true about the Bible and the Midrash, not the Bible as opposed to the Midrash. Like, that's what I don't actually buy. The Midrash is an enormously vast and variegated body of literature. There's stuff in there that you would find, and clearly do find, magnificent. And there's stuff in there that I could put in front of you that you would be like, whoa, I don't like this. This is really violent and disturbing. Look, I would back up and say, I want to go back to a question that you asked me a while ago, okay? You asked me about, what about Jews who say, all this stuff about God, I don't know what you're talking about. I want to demonstrate what it would mean to talk about God in a humane, thoughtful, and modest way. And maybe you'll find that compelling or at least more understandable, right? I'm not out to convert you, but I'm going to model for you. Here's why I read about the God of the Torah and am not horrified and don't run away and don't think it's written in some Martian language I can't understand. Let me just tell you what that's like. Another way of saying that is, look, when I do what I do as a philosopher, as a theologian, probably more of a theologian than a philosopher, I don't ever say to people, okay, let's start from sort of point zero, and let me convince you why you should believe in the God I believe in, and the God I believe in sometimes. No, let me do something else. Let me describe the world to you as it looks when you wear the lens that I'm wearing, which has been shaped both by my own experience and by the Jewish tradition. If you find this lens congenial, you are totally welcome to it. If you find this lens uncongenial, okay, so let's talk, because we all wear different lenses in the world, and I'd like to learn from you as you learn from me.
Aaron.
Right? That's what I do. That's a much more modest philosophical project. I'm now going to convince you
exactly
why it is incoherent not to believe in God. We live in a very complicated world.
Yes.
I often say, if you read the New York Times every day and are utterly convinced without any doubt that there is a good God, kind of feels to me like you might not be paying attention to the newspaper. The extent of human suffering and brutality, you know, when people say, I can't believe in God because I look around, I bow my head, I totally understand it. I am that person some of the time. I've often said, and I really believe this very deeply, to be a theologian in this day and age, you have to be able to imagine secularity from the inside. Otherwise, you are not actually living in the modern world, right? I say this all the time. I just actually wrote this in something that's coming out soon. One of the reasons I feel like I understand modern secular Jews is because part of me is a modern secular Jew. We are all complicated. We are all multiple in this way. Right? I sometimes say when people ask me, I mean, it's sort of obnoxious, but I'm trying to say something. People say, do you believe in God? Do you really believe in God? My temptation always is to answer, which part of me are you asking? Right? We're not like one simple unified entity. I got parts in me that are 12-year-olds who lost their father one day and thinks, believe in God, what are you out of your mind? And I got parts of me that have experienced the reality of the sacred in ways that take my breath away and say, of course. And then I got a million other parts in between. So let's talk about how life is complex.
That is, the way you say it now, everybody hears you. And again, I'm arguing that the wisdom of the Jewish tradition is you're supposed to live as if there's a God even when you're not sure.
Yeah, I think that's true, right? I'd like to say, you know, sometimes you have to live as if human beings are created in the image of a God you're not sure is there.
Yeah, exactly. Beautiful.
Right? Yeah.
Okay. I do want to ask you what I consider to be the toughest theological question a rabbi can be asked.
Whoa. Okay. Whoa.
So, when you use the word prayer, and then you said you want people to pray for certain things, but you want them to pray that other people get them first. I'm thinking to myself, does Scheihild mean this literally? Do you pray for things? Do you, Scheihild, take the position that there's a God in this universe who answers prayer in that sense? Does God ever suspend the laws of nature? Because I have my answer. I want to know if it's your answer. And number two, is there a God who will suspend the laws of nature for one but not another? I have my answer. I want to know what you will answer.
Mark, this is interesting. This is, you think, the hardest question?
Absolutely.
As opposed to, do you really believe in a God in a world with so much degradation and suffering? Do you really believe in any kind of God at all? This is a harder question
to you? I'll tell you why. That question is so vague. It doesn't have a tachlis to it. There's no practical consequence. Yes, I do. No, I don't. In my experience, if you really want to know whether a person believes in God as a personal, supernatural being of some kind, the question to ask, the litmus test is, how do they answer this question?
Well, it's interesting because I think here I might not quite fit into the category the way you just described it. Because, and let me say it in the most honest way I can, the God I believe in some of the time is a supernatural personal God. Do I think that that God suspends the laws of nature? I would say this. If that happens, it happens extremely rarely, and I think it probably doesn't happen.
By the way, there is a Talmudic principle. The world always follows its natural order.
Yeah, you inserted the word always there.
Always.
No, well, the phrase in the Talmud is Olam kibinago noheg, the world proceeds according to its natural course. You are a little bit emphasizing, if I can coin a word, a statement. I think the way Maimonides hears that phrase, it is always.
The sense of the verb, the sense of the line, is clear. There's a natural order. And And it seems to me the rabbis have an enormous respect for the natural order. And they do at times understand there's a human longing. The child who loses his father at 12 has every right to wish and to pray for anything that child wants. But if I'm in the Hadar Institute teaching in a classroom what Torah is hoping to direct us towards, the Torah is not directing us to think of a world where there's a deus ex machina every now and then.
So, Mark, let me try to answer your question for a minute, okay? So here's where, once again, I want to be careful. I think that when the rabbis talk about olam kiminago noheg, that the world proceeds according to its natural course, in their mind, they are describing the world as they know it. I am not convinced that that's what they thought about biblical times. I am not convinced that that's true.
I agree with you.
I'm not sure it's true that the rabbis believed there was no God who could interact with the world in a way that upended the natural order. I'm just not sure that's true. I think they believed in the Exodus as a supernatural event. I think they think that it happened that way, and that Sinai was on some level a supernatural event in which God broke into the world. I think they think that God's relationship to history has changed, right? They don't see that God. They don't know that God. I don't know that God either. The part of me that is saying, you know, if there's a God who intervenes in history, it happens very rarely, is the part of me that is deferential to the Hebrew Bible.
Okay, and the question becomes, what do you say? Not to somebody who is in grief, but somebody comes into your classroom. They're not facing any personal tragedy at that moment.
Right.
And they say to you, should I teach children in day school that if they pray for somebody, that person will be healed? And if they don't pray for that person may not be healed, and it'll be their fault.
Well, but Mark, I mean, I think anyone who would say it the way you just said it is teaching people to be brutal.
It's taught all the time.
Yeah, so
my daughter was taught that in her school. She should pray for somebody. It was a principal. You pray, and when the principal got better, the students were told they did it. Shai, you don't believe that?
No, why of course would not. You? And I would never say anything like that.
You would never say anything like
that. That's right.
That.
If you ask me, you started this by asking about, you know, something like what are people doing when they pray?
Yes.
Something like that. So, you know. What I do believe, in the moments that I believe in God, in the parts of me that believe in God, what I do believe is that God cares about people and that there is someone who hears our prayers, that God is not an interventionist. I think it's actually
that about... God is not an interventionist,
that's right.
Shai Held says.
Right.
You and I are identical.
But I actually think that what prayer makes possible, first of all, is feeling and being heard, knowing that I matter, right? I am not alone in the universe forced to deal with randomness. I am together with God in the universe forced to deal with randomness.
I don't know what you're talking about. When I'm in a Beit Knesset, it's not being with God for me. For me. By the way, I'm not talking for you.
You don't know what I'm talking about? I don't believe you.
Okay,
I don't believe you.
What I mean by that is...
You don't experience it most of the time.
I believe that most people who come to a synagogue, the reason that the Jewish tradition says, although I am absolutely, I applaud the fact that you said the Kaddish three times a day alone in your room. The reason our tradition says, and the reason why you almost were apologetic when you told me, is because you know the tradition says, you want to say the Kaddish, you say it in the midst of 10, which is a way of saying you say in a kehillah, you say it in a community. What makes people feel that they're not alone is not going into a room and feeling that in a closed closet, they're with God. You don't feel alone when you're surrounded by people who love you and care about you,
Mark, what I
and
resist,
care about the people who you care about.
What I resist here, we're kind of going back to this again, what I resist is the absolutism of your formulation. You don't experience not being alone in that way. Some people do. Some people, davening alone, feel that they are talking to a transcendent creator who cares about them.
I know.
And not only that, one of the reasons that people go to Minyan, some people go to Minyan only to be in the presence of other people who will comfort them, and some people feel like being with other people enables them to reach something beyond the world. And I'm not sure, what I'm resisting in your formulation here is, it's not X, it's Y. I think human experience is more complicated than that.
Yes.
It can be X and Y.
I agree, by the way, again, I'll say it.
And Y is sometimes possible even without the context of X.
You are correct. My concern is not for the people who already feel that. I worry for Jews who think that it's that or nothing. And I want them to know that Shai Held and Mark Golub respect their Jewish experience and their Jewish life, even if they don't if they don't feel it. If they are unable is the wrong word, if they don't experience this one-to-one relationship to God, but they find meaning and togetherness and that they're not alone in the company of other Jews in a synagogue, reciting the Shema or the Mourner's Kaddish or the Misha Berach, whatever it is, and they don't take it literally. They read it poetically.
Yeah, I've never said anything contrary to what you just said.
No, I'm saying you're but saying more. I'm saying that you want them to feel validated as well. And what I am saying is, one of the things that you've experienced in your travels around America is you go into synagogues where Jews have been taught a very simplistic Judaism, which is, there's a God in this universe, and if you pray to God, God will answer you.
Yeah, although my experience in recent years is that that's not what they've been taught.
What have they been taught?
Judaism is a cultural practice. Nobody talks about God to them. In other words, it's funny.
You're
it's
right.
almost
no,
it's almost
right.
like there's two pieces there.
Yes.
There's the I was taught to believe in a God who was kind of this like vindictive grandpa.
Yeah.
And then there's the God? Whoever talked about God in shul?
Yes.
Right? And my experience in recent years is that it's the latter more than the former.
I agree with you.
And that's where I'm not sure that your diagnosis is exactly right to me.
Okay. And my coming back now to the question I asked you earlier, why is it true that you find what you find when you travel around, is I believe that most rabbis think their congregations want them to say they believe in a God they don't believe in.
Well, that's really tragic, because I think what most people want is a role model who knows a lot, cares a lot, and is able to say, this is hard, right? So to me, right, what keeps me being able to teach theology on the days when I get out of bed and think, God, what are you out of your mind, is that no question in the world matters more to me. And a major piece of my life's work is enabling Jews to have language to talk about that question.
Mm-hmm.
Right? Because believe in God or not believe in God, God is a major character, arguably the major character, in our story as Jews. I want to find language for that, to wrestle with it, to struggle with it. That doesn't mean at the end of the day that we're all going to affirm it. That's not what I'm saying. But I want to invite people to feel like they can engage the question in ways that matter without feeling like the only options are incredibly simplistic narratives in one direction or another.
And what's the language mean? When you use the word language, are you talking about words, images, what?
I think that ultimately, I want people to be able to draw on the resources, textual, linguistic, right? I want them to know, you know, oh, here's a verse that asks my question.
Mm-hmm.
Here's a text that provides an image that I can wrestle with.
That it works for me.
Yeah, and that it is how I speak. I don't always just repeat what I was told by tradition. It is a language. Look, when you inherit a language and you learn to speak it well, you can say new things with it, right? One of the challenges I've often wrestled with is that often I find that people who speak the language of Torah best are not interested in saying new things with it, and the people who are interested in saying new things with it often don't speak the language of Torah very well, right? And what I would like to create is a generation of Jews that say, yeah, I've been armed with the language of the Masorah, of the tradition, and I can say all kinds of things with it. I can listen to it and speak with it, and speak to it as well.
You know, there is no way for me to end this, so I'm going to end it artificially. I mean, I can go. I adore you, and I think what you're doing is unique in the Jewish world. I am so privileged to be able to sit with you, and for you to let me just, you know, go at this whole theological issue with you, and we will do it many times, I hope. But I wish you now kol tov v'hatzlacha. May you only go from strength to strength. Thank you for all you do, my friend.
Thank you. Thank you so much. Thank you for having me. Really a privilege.
Shai Held, Rabbi, Doctor of Religious Studies, President, Dean, and Chair in Jewish Thought at Yeshivat Hadar, Hadar Institute in New York City. And again, I hope you've enjoyed just sharing his ideas and his feelings and his perspectives and his sensitivities and whatever dialogue I was privileged to enter into it. I hope you enjoyed listening to it all. And if you have any questions or comments you want to share with Shai Held, you email me and I will pass your emails on to him. And that reminds me to tell you, please be in touch with me this week with any thoughts, comments, agreements, criticisms, whatever you want to say. Be in touch with me this week. I love hearing from you. Please email me, write me, post on our Facebook page, or tweet me. I look forward to hearing from many of you. And always remember, you can now take L'chaim wherever you go, in the car, wherever you have a headset. You can listen to L'chaim podcast, and you can hear both part one and part two of my conversation with Shai Held. And so until the next time, I'm Mark Golub, L'chaim, my friends, to life.
Jewish Education in Media.
We would be pleased to send a complimentary DVD of this program to anyone who wishes to support JBS with a tax-deductible gift of $36, double chai, or more. Simply visit the JBS website at jbstv.org and click on the Donate button to make a donation by PayPal or your credit card. And please, indicate the program for which you would like a DVD. Or you can send your tax-deductible check to JBS, P.O. Box 180, Riverdale Station, Bronx, New York, 10471. And again, please remember to indicate which program you would like to receive with our compliments. And we thank you for your kind support.